I'm Glenn Boebert, number 51. Democrat John Smart and Republican Walter John Chilson discuss politics in America 1 year into the Obama administration. Is the system broken? Taking your calls today at 5 on the Ideas Network. And we've got Walter John Chilson in our studio, John Smart joining us by telephone from Park Falls, and we're going to talk about everything about politics 1 year into the Obama administration, the 1 year anniversary of the $787 billion National Recovery Act, the stimulus bill that Congressman Dave Obey helped to write. We'll talk about the lack of bipartisanship in Washington, the filibuster, the extremes, the Tea Party movement and MoveOn.org, the debates over job creation, health care reform, financial reform, deficit reduction, the retirement of Democrat Evan Bayh, the primary challenge to moderate Republican John McCain, and much more. All we need is you. Give us a call at 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Welcome to Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today the subject is politics, specifically the political climate in America and Wisconsin in the second year of the Obama administration and on the one-year anniversary of the $787 billion National Recovery Act, the stimulus bill that Congressman Dave Obey helped to write as the powerful chair of the House Appropriations Committee. We're going to talk about all of it today, the lack of bipartisanship in Washington, the filibuster, the Tea Party movement and MoveOn.org, the debates over job creation, health care reform, financial reform and deficit reduction, the retirement of moderate Democrat Evan Bayh, the primary challenge to moderate Republican John McCain, the Republican primary race in the 7th Congressional District, the questions regarding trials for terrorism suspects, and the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We've got two of the best political analysts to help us make sense of it all. In our studio, Republican Walter John Chilson, former congressional candidate, state senator, and the original television anchorman for North Central Wisconsin. Also joining us by phone from Park Falls, John Smart. He's a member of the Wisconsin Governor's Commission on the United Nations, a board member of the Wisconsin Alliance for Excellent Schools, and a Democratic Party activist. Well, we know you've all got political opinions, and we want to hear them. Is our government broken? If you think it is, who's to blame? Our lines are open at 261-6371. That's 261-6371. Or toll-free from anywhere you're listening, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Walter John and John Smart, thanks for joining us today.
Well, glad to be with you, Glenn.
Thank you, Glenn. Glad to be with you. And you too, Senator Chilson.
Thank you.
It is the 1 year anniversary of the Recovery Act, the stimulus bill written in large part by Dave Obey, and it's been the focal point of much of the debate in Washington. The president and Democrats say it pulled America back from a second Great Depression, and there are some economic analysts who say that it has created a number of jobs. But Republicans say the bill was a failure, 10% unemployment 1 year later, some even saying that the stimulus package hasn't even created a single job. Minority Whip Eric Cantor and a number of other Republicans making that claim. I'd like both of you to weigh in on the stimulus bill, what it has and hasn't done, and whether the perceived lack of progress poses a problem for Democrats in the November elections heading our way. John, why don't we start with you?
Okay. I think that the package was something that was absolutely necessary. And the best way to look at it, I think, is to look back at what was done by Franklin Roosevelt at in the Depression in the early 30s. And a lot of the actions that were taken then are similar to what's being done now. It's basically Keynesian theory and economic theory based on teachings of John Maynard Keynes, and the idea is basically that in a severe recession or a depression, what happens is the people who have money are afraid to invest it, and the people who would like to invest don't have any money. At this point, it comes to the point where the only one who has any money left to invest is the government, and the government is doing so. As far as whether or not this recovery bill has been successful, I would urge listeners to look up online for at recovery.gov, recovery.gov. There's an interactive map there, and you can take a look at it yourself, and it's the official figures as coming from various agencies in Washington. And I'm looking at Wisconsin right now. The total funds that were awarded to the state of Wisconsin, $2,930,400,000. Total funds received as of December 31st were $1,270,790,000. So less than half of the money that was allotted to the state of Wisconsin has even gotten here yet. On the other hand, the state
isn't that a problem that, you know, here we're 1 year into the thing and half the money hasn't even been spent yet?
I don't think that's a problem at all. I think that, you know, they couldn't just pour money into this system too fast, because that would have been worth, you know, would have wasted money in the process. But I also wanted to point out that according to the Wisconsin Department of Labor, in the last 3 months of 2009, 10,273 jobs were directly credited as having been created by these funds. So I think it's working, and I think that it's going to take time to work. And yes, we wish that there weren't the high unemployment figures that there still are, but at least it's not going the other direction like it was a year ago.
Walter John, your take on it.
Well, first I want to say facetiously that I'm not smart. He is. I think there's no question that the federal government was faced with a tremendous problem, that all of a sudden the roof caved in because of mistakes that I think were made previously by Democrats in Congress and by Democratic administration. They're still trying to blame George Bush for all the bad things that happened, but it was overspending, extending, insisting that everybody should have a home to live in, whether they could afford it or not. There were bad loans made, and all of a sudden that roof caved in. What is perplexing and surprising and inexplicable is that the worldwide the economy just collapsed almost overnight. Within a week or so, there were every country in the nation was facing some very serious problems. And I think the federal government had to do something. It's questionable whether the $787 billion program was the right thing to do. No question it has created some jobs, but were they targeted in the right place? Were they? Was there a lot of cronyism involved? I think there, no question that there was. And the TARP funds, we haven't even talked about, that rescued, and I use that term advisedly, that rescued General Motors for the unions primarily, who now own it, or the taxpayers own it. It's hard to tell which. But anyway, I think there was an awful lot of waste involved already in the way the money was doled out. And we may never know, was it the right thing to do? So it's difficult to say, was it the right thing to do or not?
We're going to take this debate now, and I'm going to play a couple of tapes for you. We talked to both of the Republicans who are running for the 7th Congressional District seat currently held by Dave Obey. And I asked both of them to weigh in on this 1 year anniversary of the stimulus bill. Let's hear from Sean Duffy, who is the Ashland County District Attorney, who incidentally his campaign was just endorsed by Sarah Palin yesterday, and he's got a big war chest. He's got about $250,000 and counting.
About a quarter of what Dave Obey has.
And I asked him specifically about the 1 year anniversary of this, and our discussion got a little bit contentious, but I think he can handle it. Here we go.
Well, when they passed that bill, there was a promise that was made that we would create 3 million jobs, and we wouldn't see unemployment go above 8%. Well, today we have lost 3 million jobs, and unemployment is pushing 10%. This bill has been an utter failure.
There are at least three widely respected independent economic analysts, IAHS Global Insight, Macroeconomic Advisors, and Moody'sEconomy.com, all saying that the stimulus bill has created 1.6 to 1.8 million jobs so far, and they all say it will create at least 2.5 million by the time it's over. Now, another independent agency, the Congressional Budget Office considers those estimates to be conservative. So when you say the stimulus bill hasn't created any jobs, according to these respected independent economic analysts, you're not telling the truth.
Well, that's not true, Glenn. There are a ton of economists on the other side of the aisle who say that this hasn't created any jobs. Actually, it's made things worse. So if you want to pull out a couple of select economists who advocate your position, we can find an economist to tell us anything we want. And we all know, because we feel it, that this bill hasn't created or produced any jobs.
Well, Sean, one of the groups I quoted again is the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. The Congressional Budget Office says it will create at least 2.5 million jobs, and it's already created 1.8 million. Are you arguing with that?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm talking about the numbers that I've seen, which is that we have lost 3 million jobs since this bill has been passed. And when you say we're going to create 3 million, and the fact is we've lost 3 million, how do you argue with those numbers?
Well, the proponents of the bill, including the president, just simple math, they're saying that we would have lost 6 million without this stimulus package. The president today said the stimulus bill saved America from a second Great Depression.
Well, this is the largest spending bill ever, and to think that we have unemployment at 10%, Glenn, indicates that this bill is not a success. And the truth is, if you add in those people who have actually stopped looking for work, unemployment is above 17%.
John Smart, I'd like you to react to Sean Duffy's comments. And to me, it's the proverbial difficulty in trying to prove a negative. Can you really prove that something would have been so much worse if it didn't happen?
Well, I read the same figures that you gave to him, Glenn, from Moody's and from the Congressional Budget Office and the rest of them, and I tend to believe those. But I understand the talking points that Sean Duffy is using, because they're the talking points that are coming direct from the Republican National Committee, and they're trying to say that over everything. I mean, I would tend to consider that Moody's and the Congressional Budget Office probably know a little bit more about it. It's also kind of interesting to bring up the fact that a lot of members of the Congress and the Senate who are Republicans and voted against this Recovery Act have been exposed lately, like 110 of them I just read someplace, who have been going around in their districts talking about how they helped to get the money that was coming into the district to help the jobs problems. And they're taking credit for something that they voted against.
In other words, they're appearing at ribbon-cutting ceremonies to claim credit for jobs, which came from the stimulus bill that they voted against, saying that the stimulus bill wouldn't create any jobs.
Right.
My point about all of this. There's an old adage that you're entitled to your opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts.
Absolutely.
And you can claim that the stimulus bill was a mistake. You can claim that it was too expensive, it's driving us too much into debt, it hasn't created enough jobs. But when you say that it hasn't created any jobs, you know, that's I think factually speaking, you have to at least say it's created some. Walter, John, am I mistaken?
Well, no, I think you're There certainly have been some jobs created in the transportation industry alone, where bridges have been fixed and highways have been fixed and unsafe highways have been fixed a little bit sooner. Being on the town board of the town of Weston, I'm familiar with some of those small things that have occurred. I've never heard the argument made, but what if the Congress, instead of spending $787 billion, would have cut taxes by $787 billion. Wouldn't that have created some jobs as well? I think there's no question it would have.
John Smart?
I think we'd have a major argument with that one, Walter, John. That's exactly what George Bush tried to do, and that's what was the basis of his tax
cut. That's what Ronald Reagan did very successfully, and that's what John F. Kennedy did very successfully.
Ronald Reagan also left us with a much larger debt than he arrived with, and the same thing happened with George W. Bush. When George W. Bush arrived, remember, there was a budget surplus, and when he left, we were $1 trillion in the hole.
Republicans in Congress.
It doesn't necessarily work. The idea that if we cut taxes on the wealthy, they will reinvest the money and create jobs has proven not to be the case. If we give them a tax cut, they simply take the money and hoard it. They don't do anything with it.
Well, small businessmen are crying for tax cuts so that they can survive.
Small businessmen are getting tax cuts.
I think
Walter John is saying that he wishes those tax cuts were more extensive and larger.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to hear from Dan Mielke, who is Sean Duffy's opponent in what may be an upcoming Republican primary. We'll see how things pan out. And if you just joined us, we're talking politics. We've got Democratic activist John Smart and Republican activist Walter John Chilson. All we're missing is you. We're talking about the entire political climate in the United States right now. Are politics broken? And if so, who's to blame? You call us and tell us. We want to hear from you. 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
We've got Democrat John Smart, Republican Walter John Chilson. We're talking about politics in America 1 year into the Obama presidency. Give us a call at 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. We'd love to hear your opinions. We heard from Sean Duffy, who is, as I said, he's been profiled by Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and The National Review as one of the Republican Party's up-and-coming stars. A National Review ran an article saying, can Dave Obey be Coakley'd, referring to Martha Coakley.
Yeah.
On the same theme, Time Magazine called him another Scott Brown, and he's raised $250,000. Sarah Palin has endorsed him. But there's another candidate, Dan Mielke, Portage County organic farmer, who was the Republican standard bearer 2 years ago. He thinks he is being treated unfairly by the Republican Party. And in an interview in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios yesterday, we asked him about that.
Well, a lot of the people in the parties do, but not the leadership. Sean has a long history of being mixed in with the Republican leadership, and I think there's a loyalty to that. And I'm a type of person that, well, I kind of go after the Republicans just as much as the Democrats when they're wrong. I'm not a, you know, just because you put an R on your name doesn't make you off limits to me when I see something is wrong. And that ruffles their feathers a little bit, because there's a lot of Republicans out there that aren't doing their job either.
Do you think you're being given a fair shake? Answer honestly.
No, absolutely not. But somehow I think that's working to my advantage. I think the people today are fed up with the way government's being run on both sides. But no, you know, I've been excluded from Lincoln Day dinners. I'm a Republican. I've been a Republican all my life. But because I don't go underneath that thumb, I've been asked not to speak or not hand out literature at Lincoln Day events. And, you know, they've tried to blackball me on that. They were looking to try to do an early endorsement. That backfired. They tried to put that campaign ultimatum with me to kind of keep me from telling anything bad about Sean Duffy or any of the Republicans. That backfired. I turned that over to the press. And so I guess I've ruffled their feathers a little bit. If I'm going to run for Congress, I'm going to run for Congress for the American people. I don't care whether you're a Republican or Democrat. I'm going to treat you with the same degree of respect or assault that you deserve. And if you're doing something wrong, if you're taking advantage of the American people, I'm an equal opportunity offender. I'll offend you on both sides of the party, because I want my country back, and I want my grandkids to have a future, and we have to do something, or we're going to spend ourselves into oblivion.
And incidentally, we at Wisconsin Public Radio have asked to have both Sean Duffy and Dan Mielke on together at the same time on the radio. And Dan is willing to do it. Sean told us that he wants to wait until the Republicans hold their nominating convention in July. But let me direct this at you, Walter John. Are the Republicans being unfair to Dan Mielke? And as a Republican, do you feel that your feathers have been ruffled, as he said?
Well, I think Dan Mielke can probably name some Republicans who have been unfair to him, or at least in his eye, have been unfair. I don't think the general Republican population is being unfair to him. There's going to be a primary, and the Republicans will have a chance to vote in the primary in September, and the decision will be made. I just hope that they, Mielke and Duffy, don't get into vicious attacks on each other, and you know that we've lost elections that way by there being too intense and vicious comments in the primary.
John Smart, is this an opportunity for Dave Obey?
Well, I would be lying if I said I wouldn't like to have them fight it out among themselves. I think it probably would. I know Dan Mielke. I've met him a couple of times and during the last campaign, and although we disagree on pretty much everything, I have a lot of respect for him simply because he's a man of strong convictions and he stands by them. And he feels like he is being treated badly by the organized Republican Party, and I can understand that. It seems like they're trying to cut him out, and I think he was a good candidate for them 2 years ago or in 2008, and I don't know. We will see what happens.
Walter John, you're shaking your head.
Well, I don't know. In the past election, I don't know if Dan Mielke won any county at all, and I think to beat Dave Obey, it's going to require substantial funding. Dan has said he's funding his own campaign, basically, but he also, today I got an email from him and asking for donations as well. So he has a man of great integrity, and I don't want to say anything bad about any candidate right now.
How bad a year, and I'm going to ask both of you this, how bad of a year is this going to be for Democrats in Congress if the economy doesn't improve? Former Virginia Governor Doug Wilder said Democrats right now are whistling past the graveyard.
Yeah, I think he was the same one who said if that election that in which Brown won wasn't a wake-up call, nothing will wake Democrats up. I think, obviously, because the economy is not turning around rapidly, economist from one of the state universities has a report out today saying we're going to have he came up with an oxymoron, a jobless recovery, that there aren't going to be many jobs created at all as we gradually recover. I think the Democrats only hope to not lose a substantial number of seats in both the Senate and Congress is for there to be a pretty good recovery in the remainder of this year. It doesn't appear that that's going to happen.
John Smart, how bad is this going to be for Democrats? Could they lose control of the Senate and the House in November?
I doubt it, but I think that the general atmosphere in the country is not so much an anti-Democrat movement as far as the climate of the economy is concerned. It's an anti-incumbent. I think that many people in the country have gotten the sense that Washington is becoming dysfunctional and that it's just not working. And I think that Republicans are going to suffer from that at the polls as well as Democrats.
All right, we got to hold it right there. We've got John Smart, a Democratic activist, Walter John Chilson, a Republican activist. We're talking politics. We're going to talk about the lack of bipartisanship when we come back with U.S. Senator Herb Kohl, 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742 to join the conversation.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities, dedicated to improving the independence, productivity, and integration of people with developmental disabilities. Wisconsin BPDD, real lives, real change.
We're back on Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin, coming to you live from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Wausau. I'm Glenn Moberg. The subject today, the state of politics in America, 1 year into the Obama administration. Our guests, Democrat John Smart, who is calling us from Park Falls, and here in our studios, Republican Walter John Chilson. We need to hear from you. Now, if you want to join the conversation, if you've got political opinions, if you think government is broken and you've got an idea of who you think is to blame, we'd like you to weigh in. Our phone number is 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. And John and Walter John, today President Obama appointed a bipartisan deficit reduction commission led by former Republican Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming and Erskine Bowles, the former White House chief of staff for the Clinton administration. This all happened after the U.S. Senate rejected a previous move for a bipartisan deficit reduction commission when Walter John, seven Republicans who said they sponsored the idea, they supported it, they backed out as soon as President Obama agreed with their ideas. Now, that kind of gives bipartisanship a bad name, doesn't it?
Well, I think it does. I think the Democrats still could have passed it by themselves without a single Republican vote, and they did not. They needed a substantial number of Republicans to vote along with them. The fact that there were a few Republicans who didn't support it is being criticized severely. I the only excuse, I was disappointed in that. I want to make that clear. But the only excuse I heard was that they had another different proposal that could come before the Senate that they preferred. I commend the president for doing this. I think he has put both parties on the spot. I think the real question will come is, will that come before the Senate unamendable, any recommendation by the Simpson Commission, Simpson-Bowles Commission, and will it, once it's passed, will that help solve things? I think there's no question it will. There's some really tough decisions that have to be made. There's no question about it, that Social Security and some of the entitlement programs are just killing this country and potentially can ruin it. Our debt is being purchased now substantially by China, you know, and they we don't need that. We've got to get off of that that ball game, and I think the commission will present a proposal that'll be tough. There's going to have to be a lot of cuts, and there will have to be tax increases as well.
John Smart, your reaction to the politics of the Deficit Reduction Commission?
Well, I'm glad that the president stepped in and made it happen as an executive decision, because he can do that, but I'm sorry that it didn't get through the Congress. And again, it's this business of the Republicans voting no on everything that the administration supports is really just silly, and I think it's gotten way out of hand. In fact, I wrote a commentary on the subject, which was published in the Ashland Daily Press and also on FightingBob.com. And it has to do with a case that I came across. The delegate from the U.S. Virgin Islands is a woman named Donna Christensen. She's a non-voting member of the House of Representatives. And she put in a bill asking that a piece of property on St. Croix called Castle Nugent Farm be added as a National Historic Site. And because of the way that the House had set up the bill under special orders, every single Republican voted against it, even though there was no cost involved, because the land is already owned by either the government or the University of the Virgin Islands.
So you're saying that the intense partisanship has simply gone too far.
It's ridiculous. And this case, as I brought up, you know, was just an example. I mean, there was no reason at all to vote against this bill.
John,
but
someone,
every single Republican voted against it, and every single Democrat voted for it.
Someone who shares your concern is U.S. Senator Herb Cole. He was in Wausau on Monday, and I had a chance to ask him about the lack of bipartisanship in Washington and also the resignation of moderate Democrat Evan Bayh, which had just happened a few minutes before we had the conversation.
We have so many problems that need to be addressed in a majority way. The only way you get to a majority is with center, right, center, left, you know, work from the center out. And Evan is one of those kind of people. So I'm very sorry he's leaving. You know, he will be missed.
Here you've got a centrist Democrat retiring, and on the Republican side, you have centrist Republicans like John McCain being aggressively challenged in primaries. It seems like we don't have a center anymore. Everything is moving to the extremes.
Well, I hope not. That certainly is not in the interest of our country. And what we need are people who are able to work together, regardless of party, to arrive at solutions that will address the problems that we have, which are serious.
Why does it take 60 votes to do anything right now in the Senate? I've checked the Constitution, and the word filibuster isn't in there.
You're absolutely right. I would do away with it today. It makes it very difficult, even on major issues, to move ahead, because you can't get 60 votes. So it becomes, to some extent, the tyranny of the minority.
The president's top domestic agenda was health care. You passed it with 60 votes in the Senate. You passed an almost identical bill, not quite, in the House.
Right.
Why can't you just get it done through reconciliation? I mean, the remaining items are budgetary. Couldn't you pass it with 51 votes in the Senate?
Theoretically, that's true, and it may yet play out that way. I don't really know.
Are you hopeful that'll happen?
Well, I'm concerned about something as important as health care being done with just one party. I think something as important of health care needs to have the imprimatur, even if it's just a few, of people on both sides.
How hopeful are you about the president's meeting with the Republicans on Tuesday?
Yeah, that's very important. It's next Tuesday, the summit on health care. I would like to hope and I expect that the president is wanting to reach out. Otherwise, what's the point of the summit?
I guess the base of the Democratic Party, a lot of them are very upset right now because, in their view, they got health care done, right? It passed the Senate. It passed the House. Now, all you have to do is reconcile the two versions. And some people are saying if the Democrats can't do this, they just can't govern. So why should we elect any Democrats at all this November or any time in the future?
Well, that's all part of the passing parade of politics, you know. At the moment, that's what people are saying. But it's pretty important for the public to realize that the Democrats have been very engaged in trying to pass a health care bill. And it would be even a better bill if it had the input from Republicans. That would make it a better bill and certainly more acceptable to the population at large. Because this is so important to our country, let's see if we can't find a way to work together. Now, we'll see next Tuesday.
If it came down to it, if you were still at loggerheads, would you as an individual senator support passing it through reconciliation if that was necessary?
It depends upon what I'm voting on. The way forward, first of all, is with people from both parties. And if we can get that, that's by far the best thing.
That's U.S. Senator Herb Kohl. We recorded that interview after a meeting of the Rotary Club of Wausau on Monday. And if you noticed, Herb Kohl was quite adamant. He wants more Republican input into the health care bill, but he would not rule out passing it with 51 votes through reconciliation if that was necessary. Walter John?
Well, I think the problems in Congress go far beyond the problems they've had with the health care bill. And when we talk about partisanship and bipartisanship needed, that goes both ways. Herb Kohl has extended somewhat of an olive branch there, and has the president, but in actuality, there has not been much compromising on the part of the Democrats. That's a real problem. And Evan Bayh, in his resignation announcement, his explanation in the Congressional Record, said had criticism for both Democrats and Republicans about the lack of bipartisanship.
In fact, Evan Bayh went so far as to say that we may be in for a Ross Perot moment in the year 2012, meaning that there could be a serious third-party challenge, maybe a third party or an independent candidate elected. John Smart, I'd like you to weigh in on all of that.
Well, it's a difficult situation, and I can understand what Senator Kohl is saying. But I was also thinking that, after all, we passed Medicare as a one-party bill. We passed Social Security as a one-party bill. I think that a lot of things end up that way, and I don't know that it can be avoided. But the way that the Senate in particular has been acting lately, as I said before, it's relatively dysfunctional. The number of filibusters and votes of cloture have gone up like four times the amount that they were like 10 years ago, and it's just gotten ridiculous. Nothing can be passed in the Senate at all anymore, unless it has 60 votes.
Well, the problem is you're in a catch-22 because you can't change the Senate rules without 67 votes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Various things have been tried, and it's possible that the vice president, as the president of the Senate, could be in a position to change some of the rules by a parliamentary procedure, but I don't think that that's likely to happen. The last time that happened, Nelson Rockefeller tried to do that, and he was eventually overruled. So I'm not sure how the Senate is going to get itself back in functioning order, but it certainly doesn't seem to be doing so now. And I know in talking to Dave Obey one time, he was talking about the number of bills that the House has passed and sent on to the Senate, and they're like a year and a half behind in the Senate. There's legislation that is, at least members of the House thought was critical, that is just buried in the Senate, and it probably never get heard.
261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones. We have Ned in Wausau. Ned, you're on Route 51.
Hi, I was just going to talk about the topic they were just mentioning and the fact that we've got a different situation than we've had previous to this. When the Democrats were in the minority, they would filibuster, for example, a Supreme Court appointment, but almost never would they do, you know, a lot of bills. And we've got something unprecedented right now. This is, in the entire history of the country, It has never been to this point. The Constitution was written such that the vice president would break ties in the Senate, a 50-50 tie. We never get to that point because we never get a chance to vote on things. When President Bush was president, he would say, just let it come up for a vote when he didn't have the majority votes or, you know, whatever he needed to have come up. Now, that's never used in reverse. If we get into a situation where the Republicans become the majority, then we could have gridlock indefinitely because you might have maybe 45 Democrats and 55 Republicans, and maybe the Democrats will just take the lead that the Republicans have now and just have continuous gridlock for eternity.
All right, Ned, thanks so much for the phone call. Gridlock for eternity, gentlemen. That's a gauntlet that's been thrown down here.
I'd like to weigh in on that question of how Congress has indeed become dysfunctional. And I'd like to point the finger of blame not at the Democrats and not at the Republicans, but at money. The problem is money. I was shocked the other day to find out that there are 57,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. And Dave Obey has close to $1 million now for his election campaign. Sean Duffy is trying to get 600,000, let's say. And that's the problem. They owe allegiance to certain segments, and they can't compromise.
How do you feel about the Supreme Court ruling opening the floodgates to unlimited campaign contributions from corporations?
I think as a result of that, I'm hoping that they will come up with a constitutional amendment that I feel the people are ready to support and limit the amount of money that severely limit the amount of private money that can be spent in campaigns.
John Smart?
I agree. I agree with everything Walter John just said.
I was hoping that would happen.
I was too. Let's hold it at that. We've reached a point of serendipity, and it's time to take a break. You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Republican Walter John Chilson and Democrat John Smart, we're talking politics 1 year into the Obama administration. If you'd like to join the conversation, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. You've got about 10 minutes to get your calls. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our guests, Democrat John Smart and Republican Walter John Chilson, and we are talking about politics 1 year into the Obama administration. Let's talk foreign policy a little bit. Dick Cheney appeared at the CCAP convention, the conservative political convention, and again, he was very critical of the Obama administration and the job they're doing in the war on terror. Cheney saying that Barack Obama would be a one-term president. Now, we've got Joe Biden in sort of a war of words with Dick Cheney, the current vice president against the former vice president over the weekend. Biden saying that the administration is actually tougher on terrorism than Bush and Cheney were, and that they've corrected some of the Bush administration's mistakes and have also reached out for the first time to moderate Muslims. So let's go first this time with John Smart. John, your reaction to the war of words between Dick Cheney, Joe Biden, and the politics of war and terrorism.
Well, to begin with, I can't imagine anybody taking anything that Dick Cheney says very seriously, but I suppose that Vice President Biden had to step forward and put out the administration side of the discussion. And I think it's really kind of silly. I think that, first of all, going back to when President Obama went to Cairo and spoke, he made a tremendous impact on the Islamic world. I don't think that people in this country are really as aware of that as they might be. People in other countries, especially Islamic countries, are now thinking a little bit more seriously about the United States, not as a land of the infidel or whatever Cheney would like us to say, but I think that they're starting to listen to us more closely. And I think that Secretary of State Clinton has done a great deal of good work over there as well by meeting with the King of Saudi Arabia and the King of Jordan and the President and Prime Minister of Turkey and a number of other places as well. I think we are actually starting to develop a sensible program, And I think that we're getting away from the idea, you know, Dick Cheney would have us waterboarding everybody. I mean, and that got us nowhere.
Well, Walter John,
we're starting to find some way around this.
Let's let Walter John weigh in on this. Is Dick Cheney being too vocal in criticizing the current administration on foreign policy?
Well, I don't think Dick Cheney is, and he does get a lot of press because obviously he has a lot of respect because of his intellect and because of his previous experience. I recall he worked for the Warren Knowles administration in Madison in my early days in the state Senate, and he was looked on then as a child prodigy, practically. And I think he is full of a lot of smarts. I don't agree with everything he says.
Some say that September 11th changed him, that after that he changed a lot of his policies and became much more of a hardliner than he had been before.
Well, I think it changed the whole nation in that regard, Glenn. It was a very serious situation. We'd never had our homeland attack in any fashion like that. And so it was a shocking, shocking thing. And it showed the extent to which some dyed-in-the-wool Muslims, some terrorist-type Muslims are willing to go, the Taliban type. I don't think that's the case of nearly all Muslims. Matter of fact, Muhammad himself preached against violence.
Mm-hmm. But should we have reacted to a violent attack on our shores and allowed ourselves to be terrorized to the point where we started doing things that we had never done before, like waterboarding people, this whole business of rendition, sending suspects out to be tortured by other countries, locking people away without bothering to even charge them with an offense or a crime, and keeping them without trial for year after year after year? Critics of Dick Cheney say they went too far and that Barack Obama has corrected some of that.
Well, I think Barack Obama is backing off on some of his ideas of bringing these people to trial from Guantanamo Bay and bringing them to New York City to put them on trial. I think that was a serious error, giving them individual rights, you know, as if they were citizens of the United States. That is absolutely ridiculous, and I was glad to see him back off somewhat on that by changing the site.
I think he's still pretty adamant about giving them civilian trials, or at least some
and
of them.
And I will argue that point, too, with Walter John, because it seems to me that what we stand for as the United States is the free will reign of law, that the law is the one that decides this. And it doesn't matter whether the person is a citizen of the United States or anybody else. We want everybody to be treated with the same kind of respect that our laws create for ourselves.
When you're at war, that does not apply. You know that.
We are not at war in a legal sense of the word. We are not at war. There's no country that is at war with us.
Anyone who doesn't recognize that we are, in fact, at war should take another look at the situation.
No, it's a question of legal definition, and we are not at war. For that matter, according to the Constitution, not at war unless Congress declares it.
Let me jump in here. If, as Walter John says, we are at war, when does this war end? And if we are in a period of endless war where you can never claim victory, does that mean we have to jettison our Bill of Rights and all of our constitutional protections and our way of life because we're at war and the war will never end?
Instead of talking about things like waterboarding, we could be discussing a much more serious problem, and that is the wars itself, whether it was right after 9/11 to invade Iraq. That's a very debatable point. And if you want to criticize the Bush administration about that, you can. You know, you want to criticize about going into Afghanistan, you can. But now President Obama has been supporting both of these wars very strongly and claiming credit for victory in Iraq. Can you imagine that?
John Smart?
I don't think he's claiming victory in Iraq. I think he's claiming that we're going to get out of there.
Well, Joe Biden, Joe Biden just said Iraq was going to be one of the great policy achievements of the Obama administration, even though he ran as an anti-war candidate.
That was Joe got his foot stuck in his mouth again.
Oh, I don't think so. And I think what he meant to say was that we will end.
What he meant to say.
Well, what he did say, that's what I understood him to say, is that we will end it. But I would like to go back to what I said before. And I think that when the president spoke in Cairo, he really brought about a whole new sense of the way that the direction of the American foreign policy was going to be going. And I think people in the rest of the world are ready to listen to that. And I think that's how, if we're ever going to end this kind of terrorism, I think that's how it has to happen. It has to happen through understanding. It has to happen through diplomacy. It has to happen through our assistance of countries that need help in various ways to bring them about to more democratic ways of understanding things.
Walter John, we have to win by changing minds and hearts as well as through military
means. No question about that. John, you said before you agreed with me on some criticism or comments I made. Now I'm very happy to say I agree with you.
And we have reached another point of serendipity, the end of the program. Walter John Chilson, Republican, former state senator, former congressional candidate, and North Central Wisconsin's first television anchorman, and also a Democrat, John Smart of Park Falls. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Mary Baldwin, and our online producer, Scott Clark. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. A reminder, you can communicate with us now on Twitter and Facebook. Find us on Twitter at twitter.com/Route51Show. If you are on Facebook, put Route 51 in the search bar, then click on our fan page.